Hi, and welcome back to the Bulwark Takes. I'm Michael Weiss, and with me today, my esteemed colleague and comrade, Mark Palamaropoulos. We're in different parts of the world. I am still in Portugal on my extended expat vacay, and Mark is in, I want to say, Vienna, Virginia, by the looks of the background. Yes, okay,
I am. Good. Just back from New Jersey, even. I survived a trip to New Jersey. How do you like that?
I survived a trip to Dublin. I actually had a great time. Ireland for me is like restorative. It's like a pint of Guinness, you know. We were in the pub till midnight. Everyone's singing and dancing. And yeah, we're satisfying all the requirements for my kid to get her citizenship. But anyway, let's move on to weightier matters, which is economic D-Day. That's what Donald Trump has threatened Iran. 6 months into a war he started and wanted to get out of almost as quickly as it began. Much to his chagrin, the Iranians haven't come to the table with a deal that he finds amenable. Rather than escalate in any kind of military or kinetic fashion, where it seems we don't have the critical munitions to defend against Iranian counterattacks, he's decided to keep the naval blockade indefinitely and impose secondary sanctions or tariffs on anyone doing any business with Iran whatsoever. Which would include, and especially the Chinese and Russians, who seem to get away with literally with murder and being spared the full might of America's economic punitive policy. Mark, what the hell is economic D-Day, and how does this differ from decades of U.S. imposed sanctions, which, after much pain and toil, and certainly more intricate kind of tweaking by the Bush administration than the Obama administration, did bring the Iranians to the table to negotiate what became the JCPOA. But now, after 6 months of on-again, off-again war, ceasefire, blockade, counter-blockade, I mean, what is this going to do to the Iranians now that this regime is fundamentally altered and the IRGC is in firm control of basically the entire country? Are they going to feel the pressure from this? Are they going to, you know, say, okay, uncle, we give up, Mr. President, we'll open the strait, we'll give up any ambitions for a nuclear weapon, and we'll lie down lambs with lions and make all of your dreams come true? I mean, what are we playing at here?
So, Michael, the way I look at this, first of all, I think you can call it, this is the least worst option, meaning the military options really aren't that great. And I think we've, you know, there's been a lot that's been discussed about this. The Iranians are not, you know, bowing down. I don't think the military pressure, in the sense of what Trump could actually do, and so take out the idea of 500,000 U.S. troops and a mass invasion of Iran, what he can do kind of politically with 80 plus days of the midterms, is continue these strikes against Iran, which don't seem to be working. So they have pivoted to what they call this kind of, you know, D-Day of economic ruin. And I think the two things on this: one is, with all of Donald Trump's kind of hyperbolic statements, you have to say, okay, you know, this was kind of a yawn. You read this, you're like, wow, he's kind of off his rocker in this thing. But it's probably the right policy because it's squeezing them economically. And I think that the key on this is, you know, who is going to kind of run out of patience because of economic ruin? The Iranians clearly are being affected, but so is the U.S. in the sense of high gas prices. And now with the idea of, okay, what does this mean? Does this mean we're going to sanction Chinese companies, European companies, others who are still doing business? How about Middle Eastern states who still have ties with the Iranians? How about the Emiratis, even though they just kind of cut down, cut off relations? And so, you know, is this enforceable? What does this really mean? So that's the thing. One, you know, is this hyperbolic, or, you know, what is the teeth here? We haven't heard from, you know, Secretary of Treasury or others on it. I imagine we might in the next couple of days. But the other part, which I think that people have to understand, is whatever we do in terms of measures like this, you know, the enemy gets a vote, meaning we should expect the Iranians to retaliate. They actually would like to see us kind of climb back up that escalatory ladder. They don't mind this tit for tat strikes, because I think they know it doesn't work, and they also know it certainly hurts the U.S. economy with oil prices going higher. And so the Iranians are not going to just take this lying down. You know, we should expect additional cyber operations. We saw the alleged attack on the water infrastructure in Minnesota. Iranian terrorist operations. We don't talk enough about their terrorist apparatus or their use of proxies. And of course, continued attacks in the Strait of Hormuz against shipping. So I don't think they're going to take this lying down. So the idea that we just announced this and this is going to be the status quo until the midterms, I think Iran might have a different idea. But let's go back to my original premise on this. Probably the least worst option. And you know, you do wonder if the Trump administration realizes that, kind of economically speaking, you know, everything is baked in already for the midterms, and so that this $4 plus gallons of gasoline, and I just drove back and forth up the East Coast, and that's what you got. Maybe that's baked in already, and so, you know, we'll see where this goes. But I mean, didn't you, when you saw this? I mean, we're long past the time of kind of freaking out on Trump statements. Well, maybe we're not. Sometimes they're a little outrageous, but on this one, I was kind of a yawn. You know, you're like, what does this mean, really? But I didn't react hysterically. I mean, I just said, they're trying to do economic stuff now. Again, least worst option.
But also least worst option, assuming Trump actually goes through with penalizing third-party countries. I mean, is he actually going to impose tariffs on the Chinese? Didn't we play this tape already about a year ago and he kind of backed down? That was where the famous taco on Russia. I mean, the Russians aren't just buying, you know, they don't import very much oil because they're in the export business. But he's talking about any countries that help Iran. Russia has been giving Iran targeting packages for American troops in the region. They've been providing military technological capabilities to the Iranian. That's a two-way street because obviously the Shahed drones that Iran gave to Russia at the early start of the full-scale invasion. I mean, I think there was some small sanctions imposed on Russian defense ministry officials a few weeks ago that kind of went under the radar. The waivers that had been in place on the sanctions that Trump did impose on Rosneft expired. So, I mean, you could say that there's been some policy, you know, sort of creep on strangling or isolating the Russian economy further. But there's a lot more the U.S. could do on Russia. I mean, this Lindsey Graham immemorial bill on secondary sanctions or tariffs on any country importing Russian oil or gas or uranium products, which cleared the Senate and now is, you know, got to come out of the House. And then, of course, Donald Trump has to sign it and then he has to enforce it, right? I mean, there's a lot we could do to punish people who are working with Iran. So far, we haven't seen that happening, right? And in fact, you know, the Chinese, what are they called, teapot refineries that have been importing and refining Iranian oil. This has been one of the reasons that prices, even though they've spiked, haven't gone through the roof, right? So is Donald Trump really going to tell the American people, as he has already, well, you just have to bear the burden for my war of choice in Iran? And also, what are the midterms fundamentally going to do? I mean, if one or both houses of Congress flip, is he going to lift the blockade? Is he going to suddenly decide right now war powers resolution? Yeah, he's got to, you know, he's got to play ball and get congressional approval for launching these military adventures. I am very skeptical that he's going to change his tune in the least, right?
So, yeah, I think the look, out of all the things to kind of get upset about in the world, and we'll shift and we'll talk to about Ukraine in a moment, because I think the Ukrainian people are really getting are subject to some punishing attacks. But, you know, after that, the tweet with Iran and the economic devastation, look, I'm more concerned that the Red Sox, after a tremendous run, then went on this losing streak for a couple of days. And that was actually affecting my mood much more. Now, they won 2 out of 3 recently. And I mention this just because I think as I've hit 57 in my old age, and I do catastrophize a bit about the world. What bothers me more and changes my mood is the Boston Red Sox. Now, you know this. Sam Stein knows it. I told Sam before the year that they would be good, and then they weren't, and now it's kind of up in the air.
Terrorism didn't get your cortisol levels spiking the way that the Red Sox do.
It's really. But so, and I say that only in that I didn't react the way I do to a Red Sox loss when I see Donald Trump's tweet about economic devastation. But let's not take our eye off just that notion that there's more to come on this. And the other thing too is there's no policy process. So I don't know who came up with this policy. I think there's no functioning national security apparatus. There's no principals committees or deputies committee meetings in which you get all the agencies around a table. These meetings are usually chaired by the national security advisor. I've attended these meetings at a lower level. It's really important. So each agency can kind of provide input on what to do on an action plan. There literally is a line that says action. I think they sit around the Oval on a napkin and come up with stuff, whether it's with the Secretary of Treasury. And by the way, Secretary of State, I mean, we can go anywhere we want today in this conversation, but the one person who's been totally absent is Marco Rubio. You know, he just doesn't, as far as Iran goes, he has sprinted so far from this thing, and he's also the national security advisor. So I think, you know, I'm not sure history is going to judge him very well for his managing this war. let's see if he wins the presidency. Maybe they would say, well, he did so for higher ambitions. But where's our Secretary of State?
I think he wants absolutely nothing to do with it because he knew this thing was a turd from the start, right? I mean, if you read Haberman and Swan's regime change and the reporting that has come out in the New York Times since, when David Barnea, Mossad director, came, I think it was with the IDF chief of staff or something, to the White House to propose going to war with Iran and talking about their grand design for installing Ahmadinejad and arming the Kurds and all of that. I mean, Rubio's response was bullshit, right? Like, he didn't believe it. Ratcliffe, CIA director, didn't believe it either. Like, there was a great deal of skepticism, even from the more quote-unquote neocon interventionist types in this administration, that this was just some pie-in-the-sky scheme that was going to fail, and it did. So I think Rubio, he's all about Cuba and Latin America and staying well clear of this shit.
It's disappointing. Yeah. I'm disappointed in Rubio. I would have hoped for more, but I guess people's ambitions kind of...
I don't even know if he has an ambition to run for president. I mean, J.D. Vance just had a fundraiser in the Hamptons, and the Omar Malik, the co-president or co-founder of the 1789 group with Donald Trump Jr., they raised like $5 million for Vance. So it seems like Vance is acting as if he is already the anointed. So maybe there's not going to be such a contest for 2020. I don't know. It's early days still and a lot can go wrong.
This message is brought to you by ZocDoc. I'm pretty good at putting off things I know I should do, and making a doctor's appointment is definitely one of them. You tell yourself, I'll call tomorrow. Then tomorrow becomes next week. Maybe you have phone anxiety. Maybe you're stuck playing phone tag with the office. And then when you finally get through, they tell you the next appointment is months away. It shouldn't be that hard to take care of yourself. That's why ZocDoc makes it so much easier. You can search and compare local, in-network doctors, see real patient reviews and detailed doctor profiles, and actually see available appointment times before you book. And instead of waiting months, you can often find appointments within 24 to 72 hours, even same-day appointments. Your health matters, and taking care of yourself shouldn't be complicated. Find and book the right doctor with ZocDoc. Head to ZocDoc.com/bulwarktakes to get started and check that appointment off your to-do list. That's ZocDoc.com/bulwarktakes.
I know you want to talk about this, so we can talk about this. This is a very intriguing story for me because as somebody who grew up with Donald Trump in the tabloids in New York throughout my entire life, you couldn't go a week without seeing this guy's face on the front page of the Daily News and the New York Post. And usually it was because of his ex-wives or his divorce or his new wives or the women he was dating and all that. You know, this is a guy who liked to portray himself, let us be quite clear, as something of a ladies' man. All these beautiful women loved him and he loved them back. And, you know, he's doing beauty pageants, all this. And here comes Natalie Harp, who is, I believe, 35 years old, fanatically devoted to this man, but devoted to him in an interesting way. I mean, clearly, you could argue based on some of the stuff that's come to light, cite Maggie Haberman, she gave an interview to CNN based on the reporting she was doing for Regime Change, a bit about just how devoted Natalie Harp is. She's written Donald Trump these soulful love letters. I'm reading this, though, as something that almost transcends a sexual romantic relationship. And it almost sounds something, you know, it's like Jonestown. This is like a cult of one where, you know, he's the guru and she's ready to drink the Kool-Aid. I mean, it's bizarre. She was part of that whole caper we talked about last time.
Yeah.
Where they were smuggled into catering cargo tin or whatever the hell it was so that he could do that bait and switch in Ankara during the NATO summit. Marco Rubio and other members of the White House staff, far more critical to national security, were on the plane that might have been blown up by the Iranians, but Natalie Harp was not. She got out. And also, speaking of security, she has no clearance. And yet, she is sort of the gatekeeper between foreign leaders, people who need desperately to get a hold of the president, and the president. So this is both creepy and bizarre, but on top of that, it's kind of dangerous, isn't it? Where did she come from and how did she get this job?
Where did she come from? Right.
It's crazy. I mean,
some weird shit. It's weird, creepy shit.
Weird shit. And her brother has been doing the rounds and he said something like, well, it's not just Trump. She's been writing letters to presidents since George W. Bush, unresponded to letters and I suppose unrequited sentiments. But Trump is like, yeah, come on in, join the bandwagon. And he hired her.
Oh, you know, I was having some fights with people on Twitter about this, not fights, but discussions, because actually I do think this is important. It's relevant. It's not sexist that this is being brought up by Senator Ossoff or others. And Senator Ossoff made an actual comment that started this whole kind of thing in the public. Then Trump went crazy. But it's relevant for a couple of things. One, let's just go back to the psychological profile that foreign intelligence services surely are writing on Donald Trump. And it's probably, you know, ordinarily these things could be pages worth of material. I think probably this is about half a page because it's just about narcissism and is you know, desire for attention. But the key thing that I think one would probably say is that he has this incredible tendency to want to have sycophants around him. And so Natalie Harp is this kind of sycophant in chief. It's weird. It's creepy. I mean, all the, you know, I think, you know, MS Now has published some of the love letters. CNN did as well. Love letters, not, but it's the you know, it's the stuff I write to you every morning when I say how devoted I am to you. You know, not really, but there's a part of this that is really important. And that's the counterintelligence world. And so she really controls access to him. It was reported, and I can't remember in which outlet, that foreign leaders know this and they use her to try to get to him. And she has a phone. And so all of these things are, you know, is her phone up on foreign intelligence collection? 1,000%. What is her pattern of behavior around Washington? You know, would foreign intelligence services be interested in her? Well, sure. I mean, that's what I did for a living against our adversaries, is look for people in the entourage around foreign leaders who you can try to get to. Maybe you don't recruit them. Maybe you put technical operations to go after their phones or computers or devices. But she has access that a foreign adversary would only dream to try to get to for a penetration. And of course, this bizarre story of her. Someone in the Secret Service or somebody said she needs a security clearance. And then she said, I don't need one. And resisted getting one for a while, which I think the Secret Service, again, according to the reports, was not happy about. But it's, you know, I think there's a huge security issue there that's not been covered enough. And the final piece is, as I lived my life in the Middle East, I walked the palaces of many kingdoms and monarchies in the Near East and Middle Eastern states, and I saw the sycophants, these kind of people around the leaders, whether it's, you know, it's kings or princes, they exist. And they exist to just really kind of dote on the leader. That should not happen in America. It's a little weird. Now, people are going to bring up things like Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton, but that was really sexual in nature. This is even this. I wish this was sexual. This is too fucking weird.
Well, we don't know. I just it strikes me as if there is a sexual element to it. I should caveat it. That's not the overriding.
No.
The driver for this relationship. There is something else going on, something psychological. But you're right. I mean, it reminds me of you know, sort of the courtiers in some kind of Central Asian potent.
What? Unbelievable. Yeah.
Bag filled with printouts of like only good news and favorable mentions of the president, right? That's her job. She carries a binder full of praise. And she has access to his truth. And we should say, I mean, so she, I think she was the one responsible for, remember that racist post?
Of the Obamas.
Yeah. That was her, right?
Yeah, it was.
I'm willing to believe this is not somebody who's necessarily racist herself, but she's so desperate to please the boss that he's like, oh, this would be funny. Can you do this? Or with unbidden, she would do it just to earn his favor, right? Like that's how far gone she is in terms of her devotion.
And I'm sorry, it's a story. I mean, you're a journalist. Like the idea that this is not a story is crazy. Someone who has much influence and access is 100% appropriate to find out what the hell is going on here. And so, sorry, that all that stuff, whether, you know, that the kind of people on the right are making a big deal about. If President Biden or Obama had someone like this, you know, we would have been all over it too. First of all, because it's just really fucking weird. But number two, there again, there's security issues, there's counterintelligence issues, and it just goes to show that the dysfunction in this White House is rather astounding. I mean, I've never seen anything like this. But you know, everything is so off the wall that when a story comes out like this story does have traction, but sometimes these things just kind of just like, oh, it's, you know, the kids' corruption, you know, the Trump's sons are making billions on this. And everyone's just kind of shrugs. Okay. Like, it's just weird because all this is against the norm.
You become completely desensitized. I mean, I remember Witkoff, you know, his plenipotentiary traveling envoy to everywhere, but mostly to Moscow. When he goes to Moscow, he flies on his private jet. And I mean, that's not outfitted with counter-surveillance equipment or anything like that. And who does he bring with him? Not his wife, but one of his side pieces, who I think he goes around describing as one of my side pieces, right? It's like a, you know, Miami real estate mogul bringing his girlfriend. I mean, you want to talk, and she doesn't have security clearance. Jared Kushner, I believe, does not have security clearance. Meeting with foreign dictators to try and orchestrate, you know, elusive diplomatic protocols with the United States. And none of the plumbing, as it were, is in place for them to be protected. You know, they're bringing their cell phones with them, their laptops. I mean, who knows?
Crazy.
It's crazy.
History will judge us very poorly on this. And for those of us who had to abide by the rules in the national security establishment, I mean, I worked for CIA, so my whole life was an open book to the background investigators. My finances, everyone I talked to, foreign contacts, everything I did from the day I popped out, you know, in 1969 in Athens, Greece, to when I retired in, you know, several years ago in 2019. I mean, it's, you know, you really sacrifice your own civil liberties, your personal liberties when you join the national security world. None of these people have. And I think for the people who actually have been subject to that, and there's a reason for it, it's insulting. Like all this shit, like I remember the head of Jordanian intelligence gave me this beautiful Omega Seamaster watch with the Royal Jordanian crest on it. I had to give it back. I can't keep it.
You couldn't take it. Yeah.
I couldn't take it. I want it. I wanted to, but of course you can't do it. And so, you know, there's so many times like that where if you abide by the rules and then you see these people, and they don't, and it's pretty wild.
Yeah. No, in journalism, I mean, you can't even let a source buy you lunch or a cup of coffee without compromising your ethical principles. It's crazy. So the final thing I wanted to talk about, I screwed up my own segue mentioning Witkoff going to Moscow, because there's been rumors that Witkoff and Kushner would go to Kyiv, although everything I'm hearing suggests that's not going to happen. And we're back to this sort of negative vibe on the Ukraine-US relationship. I wrote a piece in The Atlantic trying to inject a little bit of nuance to it. Like, look, you know, again, Donald Trump is deeply erratic, mercurial, and tying anything to his emotional state at any moment is very dangerous. It's all about the policy, right? And the policy right now is, and it has been for almost 2 years, the U.S. does not provide free of charge almost anything to Ukraine anymore. Everything that they get is paid for by the Europeans. They buy it from us. We donate it, or we rather sell it to the Europeans. They then donate it to the Ukrainians. The one thing, though, that we provide is intelligence, and that's critical. That's key. And that's been confirmed by yourself, by me from the American side, but more importantly, by me from the Ukrainian side.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that the intelligence has enabled the Ukrainians to do, they build their own, I mean, fleets of homegrown munitions, drones, kamikaze drones, which they're raining down on Moscow and other places all over Russia, as far afield as Siberia, on a nightly basis. Now it's getting a little bit interesting, though. So recently, the Brits, it was reported in the British media that drones created by BAE Systems were used to rocket inside Russian territory. And the Russians went ballistic, no pun intended, about this, threatening all kinds of retaliatory strikes or you know, sanctions on the UK. But that the British are feeling emboldened to allow their weapon systems to be used inside Russia. It says to me a few things. Number one, fear of escalation is beginning to diminish, at least among certain NATO allies, in a good way. But number two, I doubt very much, and you can speak to this, if they didn't first get a buy your leave from the United States, at least in the intelligence level, that where we end and they begin is sometimes very hard to figure out, right? I mean, there is a special relationship and it's rooted in your old line of work, right? So there's this weird thing going on where the United States, desperate for a deal with the Russians, you know, Donald Trump doesn't, there's not a week that goes by where he doesn't praise Putin and his supposed good intentions. And yet we are facilitating at least a covert, not so covert, frankly, war against Russia using the Ukrainians and allowing them to now use Western equipment to take out Russian oil refineries, Wildberries, which is their version of Amazon, warehouses that are stockpiling dual-use things that go into the Russian war machinery. So, like, let's talk about this. I mean, Ukraine has emerged in the last several years as a military technological powerhouse. We will be studying the way that they're doing this for generations to come, right? They're building stuff we need for our own purposes. I mean, I just saw a story in the Wall Street Journal that the new I forget who it is in the U.S. Army, but he canceled the drone battalion.
Yeah, I saw that.
Gee, I wonder what we've learned from the Iran and Ukraine wars. Drones are really overrated, right? They've only changed the entire landscape of everything. Now, let's talk about this. Like, Ukraine is no longer a charity case, no longer something that needs to be propped up and supported lest it be extinguished. But Ukraine is now a tutor to the rest of us. This is how you fight, you know, a peer, or in their case, a superior adversary when you don't have the manpower. This is just how you fight in general, because the nature of warfare has completely fundamentally changed. Like, what do you, your read on this as a former intel officer and somebody who clearly, you know, backyard for a while, but what's your take?
I think you're right. Amen on all that. I will say, you know, you are my everything on Ukraine. I'm being a little Natalie Harp here for you.
Yeah, you are my everything.
You are my everything on Ukraine, on Ukraine. No, but I think this is a really important point you're making, because Donald Trump's narrative is somehow that the Ukrainians are freeloaders, and that's absolutely ludicrous. But there's a couple things on this. So first of all, I 100% agree. The nature of warfare has changed dramatically, and we can learn more from the Ukrainians than they could probably ever learn from us. But let me just throw something in there. It was like this back when I was in government service. And so I remember very clearly, and I'll be careful talking around this, several U.S. National security operators, let's put it a little nebulous way, coming back from Ukraine, coming back from the East, and saying, this is really incredible for us to be there, because we're getting basically an entire kind of schoolhouse, a kind of real world view on Russian electronic warfare, on what's going on there. So we were gaining, even, you know, back in 2000 and I don't know what, 17, 18 even, we were getting tremendous battlefield knowledge. We were, from watching the Ukrainians fight in the East against the Russians. So this has been going on for some time. The other point is that the Ukrainians have also been providing us with a hell of a lot of intelligence over the years too on Russia. Ukraine is a very capable service. It's a frontline state. So, you know, this has been a two-way relationship, which many of our relationships are. Even more so now. And, you know, I agree with you totally. That notion of the U.S. kind of canceling that battalion drone unit, very weird. I don't know. There's got to be something more behind that, because that makes no sense. All the same people we talked to, everyone in the U.S. military was kind of gung-ho and pushing forward on these type of things. So I don't understand that. But a key piece on this that I think is worth kind of talking about, because it doesn't make sense, is that we are providing critical information to the Ukrainians to kill Russians in a much more decisive fashion than we ever did before under Donald Trump. I don't know why. I can't explain it. I imagine that, you know, you look at John Ratcliffe and his tenure, and I think that, you know, he deserves some credit for this. I've been critical of him on other issues, but on this issue, I don't know if he's gained Trump's okay for this. I presumably has. If he's doing this on his own, could be. If our officers in the region are being very aggressive and no one seems to care, possible. But what matters is what we are helping the Ukrainians do is groundbreaking, and we have not been done before. And you know, for those of us who have been critics of this administration, and you and I share that, you can't help but look at this and say, what we are doing now is really good. And that's where we are. I don't know. I can't explain it, but there's no doubt that this is occurring. So God bless my old organization. People are doing this, and whoever in the Trump world is okaying this, good.
God bless the French too, because the French are picking up some of the slack too in terms of intelligence sharing. You know, and the thing that kind of gets me is we're in this kind of pessimistic, oh, everything is terrible moment. Why? Because there is a severe crisis with the Ukrainians. They have no interceptors. They have no air defense against ballistic missile attacks. They've run out of Patriots, right? And we have run out of Patriots fighting the Iran war. We're down 2/3 of our stockpile, according to analysis by CSIS, the DC think tank, and our allies at the same time, we are messaging to them. CIA has briefed the Poles, the Scandinavians, the Balts, that the Russians might try something untoward in the near future. And that could range from sabotage operations, such as, you know, the Leipzig drone attack that they waged just a few weeks ago and trying to blow things up in Europe, that they've been doing that all the live long day since 2011. I mean, according to investigations we've done at The Insider, they could do cyber attacks. They've been doing that since 2007. Ask the Estonians. Or, and here's where things get really saucy, they could try a limited incursion on NATO territory. So little green men cross the border into Narva or one of the Baltic states or, you know, into Poland from Kaliningrad and occupy like a little separatist enclave. Now that in years gone by would automatically trigger Article 5, NATO war against Russia. Maybe the Russians now sense that the mood has shifted, and because of Donald Trump, they don't want to, the U.S. wouldn't come to the rescue. And so this, now would be the time to do all this. So whilst the Ukrainians are dying because of nightly ballistic missile attacks, whilst we are running short of critical interceptors, like the creme de la creme of our arsenal is Patriot air defenses, right? Just ask anybody who's used them. We are telling the Europeans, you might get invaded by Russia and you're on your own because look who's in charge in Washington. Oh, and by the way, we're asking you, please give your Patriot interceptors to Ukraine. So we wonder why the Europeans aren't lining up to fill in this shortfall. And so, but all of this is going on. The winter is coming. It's going to be a real grisly winter for Ukrainians. Not that they haven't suffered through grisly winters. There's real concerns about the electrical grid, you know, hitting substations, blacking out the country in the middle of February where everyone's freezing. But fundamentally, the dynamics on the battlefield are not going to change, right? This doesn't have any implications for the military dynamics. I mean, you could say it does at the psychological level, right? Ukrainians might, and this is the goal of the Russians, be so terrorized that they want to come out and say, let's just cut our losses and end the war on any terms. I doubt that very much because it's right. Ukraine. But here, you know, we have this new media narrative that everything is I'm talking to Ukrainians, they're like, look, you know, we don't expect a lot from the United States anymore. We need the intelligence, right? We need to be able to acquire weapons from you, which we don't pay for, or sometimes we do, but mostly the Europeans pay for. But their goal is for the next 2 years, just don't make Donald Trump do anything that's going to actively harm us. Don't right. upset the apple cart or the status quo, which is working, and the rest we can handle on our own, right? Which is kind of a remarkable turnaround in the way that they view things. Like, they understand this guy. He's transactional. He's mercenary. He's never going to give a shit about us from a humanitarian or moral imperative. So that, you know, we're not even trying anymore. It's like, what can we do? It's like a used car salesman. What can we do to put you in this vehicle today? Like, how can we make you happy?
Remember when I talked about the foreign leadership profile, a foreign intelligence service profile of a president? I mean, the Ukrainians could write this and get an A+. They have figured out Trump completely in every way. And I think they learned after that disastrous Oval meeting with Zelensky, and everything has changed quite dramatically. They have been very smart on this, on managing him. But one quick point, because two things, I think. One is, you know, we're going to see some really grisly scenes, and we have, of Russian attacks on civilian infrastructure in Ukraine. And you know, now it's getting almost normal, horribly, that there's 15, 20 people killed each night. So that's horrible. Ukrainians are going to suffer. But one question for you, is that militarily significant? That's one thing. But then number two, are people also, because I think there's, you know, morally you look at that, this is terrible. But is there some exhaustion there? Are these scenes in Kyiv and other cities of civilian carnage, is that going to shift any popular moods in Europe in particular?
In Europe, I think the Europeans have their own reasons, and you go country by country and even political block by political block for wanting the war to end. There's business interests. People want to just revive economic ties with the Russians. You have in Germany the rise of AFD, in France, National Rally, which are, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, these are Russian proxy parties in the heart of Europe. But, you know, it's interesting because one of the things you're seeing from pro-Kremlin media now, Ukraine's deep strike campaign, drone attacks hitting oil refineries, Wildberry, shutting down all four airports in Moscow on a semi-regular basis, really bringing the war home to Russians, right, where they're suffering. That's going to have absolutely no impact on the collective Russian psyche. I mean, we have the Stalingrad spirit. We have been through this. You know, we will power through. Well, excuse me, but the Ukrainians have the same fucking spirit. In fact, they have it more so because they've been at war with you for a decade plus.
Right, right.
You took over Donbass, and now you've been waging this terrorist campaign against the capital city and population centers since February of 2022. Most Ukrainians, and the polling has been quite consistent, do not want to forfeit territory to the Russians, not because, you know, they're being unpragmatic or they're being, you know, sort of quixotic in what they think they can achieve, simply because they've seen what happens when the Russians come to town and occupy their territory. You know, men, women, and children get raped, disappeared. Catholic priests are gone. Churches are destroyed. I mean, it's horrific, right? They don't want that to happen. So do I think that this is going to somehow chip away at their resolve to carry on or do what they need to do to defend themselves? No, I don't. I think it's going to piss them off and make them angrier. Yes, it's going to be a horrific winter, but they've been through a lot worse already, you know, collectively. And by the way, we don't know what workaround solutions they've got in place, right? One of the things to do is this campaign of kill the archer instead of shooting down the arrows, right? So use their own fleet of cruise missiles, and now they've got ballistic missiles that are coming down the pipeline. Take out the launchers in Russia so that the damage the Russians can do is somewhat mitigated. Nobody is under any illusions that the war will continue past this winter. I think it's very consistent on the Ukrainian side in that regard.
Hey, by the way, you used a great word. You used a great word. I got to use quixotic. Quixotic. Very nice.
Like Don Quixote.
I know. But that's a great word. What is it? Idealistic. To the point of what? Being silly or something like that, right?
The Ukrainians are very savvy. They understand reality. I mean, nobody has to explain what's going on in their country to them. They're quite across it.
That's a good word. I used to do in cables I used to write for CIA. I always try to throw in a word that I know that I knew half the readership would have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well, you went to Cornell, man.
Some of it had a little Greek. I used to use Sisyphean all the time. It's pretty good.
That's a good one too.
It's a Sisyphean task. So
I think there's like a school of Eastern philosophy that says, well, maybe Sisyphus just enjoyed rolling the boulder up every time.
Speaking of, we will do another episode here on my newfound philosophical tilt now towards Stoicism. I've been reading, do I have the books here? I've been reading Marcus Aurelius. I've been Ryan Holiday, who's kind of this modern Stoic. Obstacle is the Way. So I've been reading a lot of Stoicism. And so I might have found my religion here. So I went to an Avenged Sevenfold concert. It's a heavy metal band I loved. I went to Philly the other day and I saw the guy, the bartender had a tattoo of Marcus Aurelius and he was a big Stoic. The bartender, and he was former military. And so I was chatting with him. So we're going to do an episode on Stoicism because I think the listeners, people will appreciate this. My newfound take on life.
I do want to say that you should all subscribe to The Bulwark. And apparently you can do that clicking whatever buttons are below you watching this. I'm Michael Weiss, and you've been listening to The Bulwark Takes. And with me, as always, Mark Polymeropoulos. We will see you next time. Cheers.